the charge of anti-Semitism, it's much easier to weaken the institutions that they have, that they already despise. Those institutions being the university, democracy, immigration, for example. Anti-Semitism has become an incredibly potent tool to dismantle what remains of U.S. democracy. And we see far-right organizations in Europe which have drawn inspiration. Of course, there's a lot of overlap between these groups. There is a kind of right-wing international. But I think what we also have to emphasize is that there is a deep attraction on the part of far-right leaders and movements to Israel as a state, because Israel is an ethno-national state based on racial exclusion, based on policies of oppression, of dispossession, of apartheid. And for that reason, Israel has a strong appeal to these right-wing organizations, right, and leaders who love deportations, who love building walls. Israel is seen as a kind of model.
Well, Adam Schatz, we thank you so much for being with us, U.S. editor of the London Review of Books. We'll link to your piece, your latest one, The World Since October 7th. And we're going to have you back to talk about your book, The Rebel's Clinic, The Revolutionary Lives of Franz Fanon. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. On That Vegan Show, you will hear in-depth guest interviews on vegan-related topics, such as companion animals, environmentalism, social issues, and food and nutrition. We also learn about specific animals, such as possums and rabbits, including their needs and ways to help them. Be sure to tune in to That Vegan Show on the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m., right here on KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Jazz Society of Oregon, presenting the 45th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival. Friday, July 18th through Sunday, July 20th at Cathedral Park under the St. John's Bridge in North Portland. Featuring local jazz, blues, soul, and Latin artists such as the Revival Brothers Band, McTuff, Tezetta Band, and more. More information at jazzorgan.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a hot week has been fueling wildfires and pushing firefighters to the edge. The Pacific Northwest federal lawmakers again push back on the president and his budget cuts. And will psychedelics become more widely available as medical treatments? Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 17th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Oregon is experiencing an active wildfire week, especially in the central and eastern regions, prompting a statewide state of emergency declaration from Governor Tina Kotek. The Cram Fire, the largest active fire northeast of Madras in central Oregon, rapidly expanded to more than 64,000 acres, fueled by hot weather, gusty shifting winds, and low humidity. It was reportedly started by a transformer. Resources are focused on suppressing the fire and protecting structures, with residential areas and key infrastructure at risk. Evacuation orders are in place for parts of Jefferson and Wasco counties. Several other fires are burning across the state, especially in southern Oregon, including the Elk Fire in Klamath County, which is over 1,000 acres. Many of these fires were caused by lightning strikes. The fires have led to air quality advisories for Klamath and Jefferson counties due to smoke. There have been no reported fatalities this fire season, but six people have been injured. Here's Crook County Fire and Rescue Chief Matt Smith describing how the Highland Fire impacted his community.
We provide protection, Powell Butte, Juniper Canyon and Prineville. It covers about 450 square miles. And we also do the ambulance service in Crook County. There was a report of a wildland fire starting on Highland Road and right there close by. And I think probably if you were there, you saw it immediately. Thankfully, we actually had crews in the area. We had another emergency call going on a couple blocks away, so we had a very short response. And when we arrived, we immediately knew we're going to need our friends to help. And that's really what part of the story we want to tell is the fire protection that you have with us as the local, the state of Oregon, and our federal partners. It really is a tremendous response that surges in to help. And really what is overwhelming for a local district to deal with, because we just don't have these resources. So within the first three minutes, we start setting up a command post. We call our federal partners. They start to arrive, and that really starts this large surge of resources.
Oregon has invoked its Emergency Conflagration Act multiple times to mobilize additional firefighting resources. State and federal agencies are working to prevent and respond to the fires. Fire danger levels are expected to remain high with above normal fire activity anticipated throughout September. Both red and blue states have recently been interested in the potential medical use of so-called psychedelic drugs. Now the Trump administration, as supported by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., wants to approve them at the federal level. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Despite its overall conservative leanings, the Trump administration may be poised to approve the use of currently illegal and mind-altering drugs in treating a variety of emotional issues. Proponents of psychedelic drugs have been appealing to Washington for decades to allow the therapeutic use of substances like LSD and ecstasy. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has no medical training, recently told Congress, quote, "This line of therapeutics has tremendous advantage if given in a clinical setting, and we are working very hard to make sure that happens within 12 months, end quote. Meanwhile, the potential use of psychedelics is gaining traction in deep red states like Texas. Some proponents are a bit concerned about the federal support by Kennedy, who is already well known for controversial and medically unsupported views on vaccines, antidepressants, and fluoride. Rick Doblin, the president and founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, said, quote, "I'm quite optimistic, but I'm also worried that the message the public might get is, well, RFK likes psychedelics, and now it's approved," end quote. The FDA rejected MDMA, or ecstasy, is a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder under the Biden administration, citing flawed data and questionable research. Regulators called for a new study, which would have taken several years. To date, there has been no U.S. approval of a psychedelic for medical use. Now, the agency appears ready to reconsider. The organization has called the evaluation of MDMA and other psychedelics a top priority, and it even hinted at a variety of initiatives that could be used to accelerate their approval. One program is intended to expedite drug approval for substances that serve the health interests of Americans by cutting their review time from 6 months or more to as little as 1 month. The FDA may also waive the normal requirements for agents to be tested in rigorous controlled studies that include a placebo. That approach, long considered essential for high quality and reliable research, has been a problem for psychedelic studies in which patients can almost always correctly guess whether they have received a drug or a sugar pill. In addition, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and FDA both recently hired several new staffers with ties to the psychedelic movement, and a number of veterans lobbying for psychedelic access have already met with Trump Secretary of Veterans Affairs Doug Collins. As a failed presidential candidate, Kennedy discussed how his son and several close friends benefited from using psychedelics to deal with grief and other issues. Some experts worry the hype surrounding psychedelics has gotten ahead of the science. Philip Corlett, a psychiatric researcher at Yale University, says bypassing the rigorous clinical trials mechanism could jeopardize patients. He said, quote, "If RFK and the new administration are serious about this work, there are things they could do to shepherd it into reality by meeting the benchmarks of medical science. I just don't think that's going to happen," end quote. Oregon and Colorado have already legalized psychedelic therapy. And last month, Texas approved $50 million to study ibogaine, a potent psychedelic made from a Western African shrub, as a treatment for opioid addiction, PTSD, and other conditions. dead substances on the U.S. government's ultra-restrictive list of illegal Schedule I drugs, which also includes heroin. Ibogaine can cause dangerous, irregular heart rhythms, which could be fatal if left untreated. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon's new groundwater law no longer addresses severe nitrate contamination caused by industrial agriculture in eastern Oregon, according to some environmental groups. As Isabel Shirley reports, they say the state's inaction leaves rural residents vulnerable to pollution.
Environmental groups say Oregon's new groundwater law meant to curb pollution has been diluted to the point they can no longer support it. Industrial agriculture has contaminated parts of eastern Oregon's groundwater with nitrates from fertilizers and manure, putting residents, many of whom rely on wells for drinking water, at risk. Caleb Lay of Oregon Rural Action says earlier bill versions would have protected residents and held polluters accountable.
Unfortunately, as the legislative session went on, we saw industry groups and big ag groups get more and more heavily involved. And we really saw the governor concede many of the really important points in this bill.
Nitrates are increasingly linked to cancer, miscarriages, and birth defects. Governor Tina Kotek says the new bill gives state agencies more authority to intervene in Oregon's contaminated groundwater areas. Boardman resident Jim Klipfel moved to the area 6 years ago and discovered his well was contaminated with nitrates after a neighbor warned him not to drink from the hose. Now he relies on delivered water as officials work on connecting residents to city water. He says there are more stories of illness in the community than average.
Scientifically, yes, I know this can't be 100% tied to the nitrates, but it's a pretty huge freaking coincidence. People getting cancer, people having miscarriages, people losing farm animals, horses, cows.
A 39-page amendment removed key pollution control measures, Lay says, including a mandate for agencies to review and tighten groundwater pollution permits. He argues the industry has too much influence over the law.
We need to shift that power back where it belongs, and that is to the people who are on the front lines of their pollution. It's to the rural, working-class, low-income residents.
A report from January shows that nitrate levels continue to rise across the Lower Umatilla Basin groundwater management area in Morrow and Umatilla County. About 40% of tested wells exceeded safe drinking water limits. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
2.6 million tons of plastic packaging and foodware end up in California's landfills every year. As Suzanne Potter tells us, a new report from Ocean Conservancy gives the state a near-perfect score in fighting plastic pollution, but says good implementation of policy is key.
California receives high marks in a report on the fight against plastic pollution. This is Plastic Free July, and the United States of Plastics report from Ocean Conservancy awards the Golden State a score of 4.5 out of 5. Report co-author Dr. Anya Brandon with Ocean Conservancy largely credits Senate Bill 54, California's landmark law passed in 2022.
It holds plastics and other packaging producers financially responsible for managing their wasteful products, and it requires that producers make 25% less single-use plastics by 2032.
The state also banned most plastic grocery bags a few years ago. Starting next year, the thicker plastic bags now sold at checkout stands will go away. Consumers will have to go back to paper bags or bring reusable cloth bags. Brandon says California still has more work to do, adding that the state has been slow to implement SB 54's ban on expanded polystyrene foam, which was supposed to take effect last January.
The state agency finally issued guidance and an enforcement portal literally this week. So it's 7 months late, but they are finally getting around to enforcing that critical component of the law.
The report also finds that California is the only state with a law directly addressing pollution from pellets used to manufacture plastics. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Oregon First District Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici visited the Beaverton School District Summer Meal Program to help distribute meals and meet with school staff, students, and parents. She was also there to talk about the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that was recently signed into law. She warns it will decimate SNAP and hurt nutrition programs.
I call it the one big, bad, ugly bill. I don't see anything beautiful about this bill.
and particularly with my work over the years on education and children, the SNAP cuts as well as the Medicaid cuts are going to be devastating. And our hospitals and clinics are catastrophic. But with regard to SNAP, with the eligibility requirements changed, oftentimes when students are eligible for SNAP, it's smooth for them to get school meals. This is going to make it so much harder and put a lot more burden on our state, too. And with all of the funds that are being cut from the federal government, the state is really going to struggle. And that's just going to come down to hurting kids, hurting their learning ability, hurting the future. And it's especially frustrating because they didn't need to do this. They needed to find a way to pay for tax breaks for billionaires and successful corporations that don't need tax breaks. So it's particularly frustrating and harmful. We tried to stop it, but we couldn't, but we're not done fighting. The SNAP requirements, it's my understanding, they made some changes in the Senate. We're still figuring out if they're going to be phased in. But right now, we still have a lot of food insecurity here in Oregon. I'm at the Loa Park School in the Beaverton School District, but across our state in urban, suburban, and rural areas, there are too many kids who are still hungry. And so over the years, I've supported something called community eligibility. And that means when a certain percentage of students qualify for free and reduced lunch, the whole school and sometimes the whole district can just serve meals to everybody. That's the way it should be because it reduces stigma and it also cuts down on burdensome paperwork. So we're moving away from that with this bill, with the additional work requirements on SNAP and Medicaid. And most people who are getting SNAP and Medicaid, if they can work, they're already working. And if they're not working, there's a good reason why they're not. So we're going to see some devastation and more hungry kids. And kids can't learn when they're hungry, which is why I'm here to serve the kids today and to show the school and the community how much I support these programs to get kids. There were so many changes being made in this massive bill, and then they kind of rushed it through. I do want to note that my Democratic colleagues and I offered more than 400 amendments when it came back. And some of those amendments were to do things like, don't let the bill go through if it has SNAP cuts, and don't let these Medicaid cuts go through until we get some assurance that they aren't going to hurt community health clinics and Medicaid recipients. Another thing I want to emphasize, too, is that these cuts don't just hurt people on Medicaid or SNAP. They hurt the whole community. If our clinics need to cut back because they aren't getting Medicaid reimbursements, whether that be at community health clinics or hospitals, that affects everybody because people still get sick if they don't have insurance. They just wait and get care in the emergency room, and so if emergency rooms are backed up, that harms the whole community. So, again, it's a really tough time as people are processing this and trying to figure out, as it's implemented, what it's going to mean to our communities. And I also want to note that a lot of people who get benefit from Medicaid, this is our Oregon Health Plan, are kids. So it's like with SNAP, if the eligibility is changed for their family and their family's not eligible anymore, that's going to hurt them. But also, if Medicaid cuts affect them, they won't be getting their health coverage either. So it's a wrong direction for our country. Kids are in education, and that includes school nutrition, some of the best investments we can make. Members of Congress oftentimes don't have the ability to challenge cases in court, but the affected parties do. And our Attorney General, Dan Rayfield, has been involved in a lot of those cases. So looking at places where cuts or changes are either unconstitutional or illegal, those will likely be challenged in the court. But as we continue to see how these cuts are affecting communities and hearing from people across Oregon, across the country, particularly with these Medicaid and SNAP cuts, we're going to be seeing some really serious challenges. So hopefully we can work with our colleagues on both sides of the aisle until Democrats are back in the majority can actually stop these. We can work on saying, look, you said this wasn't going to hurt your community. I know a lot of them were saying, oh, this is just getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. That's impossible. The cuts were too massive. So hopefully when people start hearing from their own constituents, people who voted for this bill, they might come back and say, look, this is not what we expected. Let's see if we can make some changes to protect access to health care. I want to hear from people here in Northwest Oregon. Please contact me. Tell your story. We're going to do everything we can.
And that was Oregon Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici. The U.S. Senate has now approved a White House request to claw back $9 billion for foreign aid and public broadcasting as Republicans bound to President Trump, surrendering congressional spending power. The 51-48 vote came over the objections of all Democrats and two Republicans. Most of the funds, about $8 billion, were for foreign assistance. The remaining $1.1 billion was for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds NPR and PBS. The House is expected to give final approval to the package later this week, sending it to Trump for his signature. Before the Senate's vote, Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray spoke out strongly against the defunding.
2 weeks ago, Republicans passed the most expensive bill in the history of the Senate. Why? To cut taxes for billionaires and at the same time cutting Medicaid and SNAP for needy families. But now, Republicans are pretending they are concerned about the debt. So concerned that they need to shut down local radio stations. So concerned they're going to cut off Sesame Street. They're so concerned they want to whack away at our global credibility and slash humanitarian aid in the process. The idea that this is about balancing the debt is laughable. You could cut every dollar ever spent on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting since it was created, and it would not cover the cost of the bill that the Republicans just jammed through. You could cut every dollar we have spent on foreign aid since World War II, and that total would still fall short compared to the cost of Republican tax cuts. Or how about this? If Republicans cut the amount in this rescissions bill every single day for a year, it still would not equal their tax cuts to help rich donors. Let's stop pretending this move is about the debt. And let's stop pretending there's no alternative to passing a partisan rescissions package that cuts bipartisan funding, because I have been clear over and over, there is an alternative, which is to do what we always do and discuss rescissions as part of our annual funding bills instead of doing Trump's bidding. Let's talk about what's at stake here. Starting with the damage that these cuts would do to our communities by cutting rural areas off from local news and emergency alerts, and ending high-quality kids programming. If Republicans pass this package they're offering, they're going to slash funding for over 1,500 local news stations nationwide. These are stations that provide an enormous community service, especially in rural areas and in our tribal communities. They cover stories that matter to families, but that often get overlooked by national news. These stations and this funding reaches 98% of all Americans. And let's not forget, they also deliver local emergency alerts. Some of these local radio stations are a genuine lifeline for communities when disaster strikes. Who among us thinks our communities should have less warning when there's an emergency? Because that is what voting for this package means. It also means cutting off funding for high-quality kids programming. There's a reason shows like Sesame Street are beloved by kids and parents. It's not just entertaining. It gets our kids thinking. It teaches them about math and spelling and caring and kindness. And if Republicans let shows like this get canceled, they're going to open up the floodgates to a wave of what I call brain rot TV that is engineered to keep our kids watching. To my colleagues who think they have short-term temporary fixes to reduce cuts to one or two public radio stations or televisions in their states, that will not solve the problem. And what do you say to those 120 rural stations that will lose 25% or more of their funding? What do you say to the dozens of rural stations that will shut down because of this bill and cut off local news, educational programming, and life-saving services to the rural communities that we serve? And let's not forget, the other cuts in this bill would seriously undercut our credibility on the world stage. I thought American leadership was worth investing in. And when we voted for those funds, so did Republicans. Did Republicans forget why we thought that was important when we voted for them? Did Republicans forget that outbreaks spread if we do not help stop them? Did they forget that humanitarian assistance doesn't just prevent death, but it prevents chaos and conflict, keeps our American troops out of harm's way. Did they forget that these investments bring business to our American companies and they help feed the world? Or that building alliances and playing a leading role at international organizations allows us to advance our interests and counter our adversaries? And set aside the global strategy for the moment. We should not be voting to let children starve or die from preventable diseases. We should be voting to go, shouldn't be voting to go back on our word to the world. Saving a couple pennies is not worth losing our credibility or causing millions of deaths across the globe. It's not even close. If Republicans really care about the debt, they can start by revisiting the $4 trillion in tax breaks they just showered on billionaires. Now, Mr. President, there's a lot more to say about how damaging these cuts would be for our country, but you don't have to take my word for it, because even several of my Republican colleagues have said it themselves. They don't like this package. They're already trying to dial it back the tiniest bit, but I do know they have concerns. Here's a tip. If you don't like it, don't vote for it. Think about who you take orders from, President Trump, Russ Vought, or your own constituents and your own communities. And let's be honest, for all of his bluster, President Trump will forget about this in a week. He doesn't care about rescissions. He probably doesn't even know what it means. And if you don't like this package, but you think you should do more targeted rescissions, you know what? We can discuss that in a bipartisan way, completely separate from this partisan package. I've been clear, and I will say it again right now. I stand ready to discuss rescissions as part of the bipartisan spending bills, just as we have always done. That is the right way to go about this. At no point in our country's history, no point, have partisan rescissions been regular order. Anytime we've done this in the past, it has been bipartisan. Republicans should join us to make sure this does not become a bad new first, and to ensure that our time on the floor is spent considering important legislation, including our funding bills, rather than one rescissions request after another. We are working right now to advance FY26 bills, right now, at this very moment, and hopefully in a bipartisan way. We passed the first two out of committee last week. I want us to continue that work. But I really worry that passage of these bills is going to complicate the road ahead even more. Because if Republicans decide it's fine to undo the last bipartisan spending deal with Trump's partisan cuts, then getting these bills across the finish line is going to get really hard. And if they keep this kind of thing up, one of these days Republicans are going to find they broke the process. Let me spell out what that looks like, because I think there's a misconception here that wrongly convinces some members it's okay. This is the straw that won't break the camel's back. The reality is, bipartisanship doesn't end with any one line being crossed. It erodes, it breaks down bit by bit until the day there's nothing left. Don't get me wrong, the negotiating table is always there. And in my experience, there are usually a few members willing to stick it out and work as hard as they can to get a result. But here's the thing. The Senate doesn't work off of a few members. It works off of consensus, building, and bipartisanship. And the more bridges you burn, the fewer paths you leave to get things done.
President Trump's press to name a special counsel for the Epstein case. Speaker Mike Johnson urged the Senate to not change the cuts in the rescissions bill. And undocumented immigrants are no longer eligible for bond before deportation hearings. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
He's dead, he's gone, and all it is the Republicans, certain Republicans, got duped by the Democrats, and they're following a Democrat playbook.
President Donald Trump is doubling down on denials relating to dead billionaire sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. He says Attorney General Pam Bondi has his permission to release any documents not protected by secrecy. Bondi denies the Justice Department is withholding anything incriminating. When asked if he would appoint special counsel for the case, Trump said it's not his decision. This comes as Trump has fired Maureen Comey, a prosecutor on the Epstein case and daughter of former FBI Director James Comey. Polls show most voters disapprove of the president's handling of the case. Trump appeared 7 times on the flight logs of Epstein's private plane, nicknamed the Lolita Express. House Republicans have repeatedly blocked a Democratic bill forcing justice to release the Epstein files, but some GOP hardliners now say they'll work with Democrats on the issue. Kentucky right-winger Thomas Massie and California progressive Ro Khanna say they're considering a discharge petition to force a vote. Meanwhile, the House and Senate are working to pass a budget rescissions bill by Friday. The legislation would claw back $9 billion appropriated for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and USAID. Some senators want to cut NPR and PBS, but still want to fund their local public media stations. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson.
You're talking about funding for USAID, the egregious abuses that the DOGE analysis and audits uncovered. We've got to claw that back. The American people, everybody demands that. We can't fund transgender operas in Peru with U.S. taxpayer dollars.
The State Department did provide less than $60,000 for an LGBTQ+ opera by an American composer in Colombia and a comic book with a transgender character in Peru, a minuscule fraction of the aid budget. Pushback from Republican senators looks likely to rescue the PEPFAR anti-AIDS program, credited with saving 25 million lives, mostly in Africa. The Trump administration is saying illegal immigrants are no longer eligible for a bond hearing while they fight deportation. Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons says illegal immigrants should be detained until their cases are decided, which could take years. Rosa Santana is with Envision Freedom Fund, the nation's largest immigration bond fund.
Stripping millions of immigrants of their right to a bond hearing is a chilling escalation of this administration's unending attacks on due process and basic human dignity.
During a Senate confirmation hearing, former National Security Advisor Mike Waltz discussed what he would do as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. He faced harsh questions from senators for starting a later leaked Signal chat thread, which mistakenly included the editor of The Atlantic magazine. Waltz defended his use of Signal for discussing military secrets by citing Biden-era guidance.
It says here, I'll read it to you, use only end-to-end encrypted communications.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 17th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet,